I'm Eric Sawyer. I'm a co-founder of ACT UP New York, of an organization called Housing Works that houses homeless people with AIDS, and of an organization called Health Gap, which does advocacy around HIV and access to essential medicines. I now work for UNAIDS, the joint co-sponsored program of the United Nations on HIV. It is the primary policy and programmatic secretariat for all of the UN agencies' HIV programs.
Where were you born?
I was born in upstate New York to a middle-class family. Most of my ancestors are dairy farmers. My father was a truck driver.
And when were you born?
I was born in 1954, so I'm 57 years old.
Do you identify as a gay man?
I do identify as a gay man. I do self-identify as a person living with HIV. I'm one of the longest-term survivors of HIV, having developed symptoms in 1981, actually 30 years ago, when HIV had not been discovered, the HIV virus, and when the symptoms I was experiencing were called GRID, the gay-related immune deficiency.
Can you tell me a little bit about your having grown up upstate New York and how it was at the time to be a gay man before you moved to New York City?
Sure.
The kind of life that you led and the perception of homosexuality at the time, if you will.
Sure. I grew up, I was born in the 50s, 54, and went to grade school starting in 1960. And graduated from high school in 1972. So I was, growing up, before really the gay liberation movement was born. It was born in 69. So when I was a sophomore, had three more years left in high school. And at that point, homosexuals were a joke. There was one kind of identified, queer in our town who was kind of, an alcoholic, somebody that everybody made fun of in town, who, hung around in one of the local bars and, often, was on the sideline of sporting events, and the joke was always, oh, he's just here to look at the boys. I was a very sensitive kid. I cried easily. I had two older brothers who were major jocks. I was always really tall and thin and a bit uncoordinated, and was kind of made fun of as being a sissy. I was very dramatic, liked movies, was, into band and chorus and drama, and it wasn't until I became good in athletics around the time when I was 15 or 16 and got bigger physically than everybody else that people stopped bullying me. I was big enough to kick their asses then.
As you were growing up, were there any people, be it in popular culture or in other larger cultural fields, that you were identifying with as a gay person?
No, there really wasn't hardly anybody out as being, gay when I was growing up. And that made it really hard. I always tried to have a girlfriend. I started having sexual experiences with guys and girls at the same, the same time. Actually as a, really young kid in elementary school, when you were playing doctor with, the kids in the neighborhood, I was playing with both boys and girls and experimenting, sexually with both boys and girls. And it was only when an older brother, kind of beat me up literally for, catching me having, sexual contact with another boy that, and told me that boys weren't supposed to do that to other boys, that, and if I didn't stop, he was going to kick my ass, that I, kind of realized, oh, well, maybe that attraction's not normal and I, should suppress it, and, tried also based on all the bullying and being called a sissy and a little faggot, that I, you know, tried to suppress that part of my behavior.
And you suppressed it for how long?
Until actually I was a freshman in college, and when I was a freshman in college, I actually had sex with my girlfriend, and I always had a girlfriend all through high school, but was never sexual with her, not for want of trying, but just never actually had sex for the first time until I was a college freshman. And I got drunk and had sex with a guy in, you know, the college dorm the same week that I, you know, finally scored with my girlfriend. So, ironic, but, and then, you know, continued to have sex primarily with my girlfriend, but also was occasionally getting drunk and having sex with, you know, a guy at college.
What did you study and where did you go to school?
I went actually to a state university in upstate New York, and I studied psychology, I think primarily to figure out, you know, why I was sexually interested in men. It wasn't actually until I was a senior and had taken a couple of courses in alternative sexual development and in sexual deviancy and adolescent, you know, sexual behavior, that I was exposed to, you know, a group of gay activists from New York City who came to the university at the invitation of a psych professor and a psychology professor, who talked about, you know, a gay lifestyle as an alternative lifestyle and not as an illness, as it was still classified in the, you know, the American Psychological Association list of diseases. And it was kind of the first time I started to think, oh, well, maybe it is actually okay to be attracted to other men, and maybe I'm bisexual, you know, maybe I should, you know, go to a graduate school where there is a gay and lesbian association like this individual was a representative of, so that I could, you know, perhaps get exposure to people who didn't, you know, run away the day after a sexual experience and didn't say, oh my God, we were so drunk last night, we can never do that again, you know, don't tell anybody, you know, what we did, and I don't want to ever do that again, so don't try it. It was actually in graduate school, after I, you know, found a gay and lesbian organization and picked a graduate school, because they were actually written up in Time magazine. I went to the University of Colorado in Boulder, and there had actually been marriage certificates issued by the town clerk in Boulder, Colorado, the first ever anywhere in the U.S., and nobody really knows about it, in the 70s. There was a gay liberation organization there, and Ginsburg actually was a teacher at the Europa Institute, which was a Buddhist institute in Boulder, and, you know, helped organize this gay and lesbian association on campus. And that was part of why I selected the graduate school that I went to.
And in graduate school, you were also studying psychology?
No, in graduate school, actually, I studied public administration. I kind of decided my senior year that while, you know, psychology was interesting, I didn't want to be a psychotherapist, and you couldn't really do much other than be a teacher or a psychotherapist, and that I would rather have a career in business.
When did you move to New York City, and what were you doing here when you first came?
I moved to New York City in 1980, and when I moved here, I got a job working for American Standard Corporation, which is a plumbing supply products company, and eventually went to work for Citibank and Human Resources, and then eventually went to work for a Human Resources consulting firm. you know, prior to being forced onto long-term disability with an AIDS diagnosis.
What kind of community did you plug into, when a gay community, when you moved to New York? Or were you pretty much on your own at that point?
Well, I decided to move to New York primarily because I realized that being an out gay man, and I, you know, came out while I was in graduate school in Colorado, that living in a small town like, you know, Boulder and Denver, the capital, which was like a half an hour away, was really limiting if you were going to be gay, because it was, you know, a mountain, you know, hick town, and, you know, realized that, you know, flying to San Francisco for a weekend or to New York for, you know, a week, I had, you know, far more interesting times and slept with more men in, you know, those short visits than I slept with all year in Colorado. And I had, you know, basically there were like a couple of bars in Denver. Everybody who was gay went to them. I had either dated or had sex with everybody I was attracted to in any of those bars, and none of, you know, none of the relationships stuck. And I was like, if I'm ever going to have a successful relationship, I better move to New York quick. So I did. And when I moved to New York, I, you know, kind of fairly quickly got into the, you know, gay scene. I met people like Larry Kramer, who had written a book called Faggots, you know, by the time I moved here. And he was, you know, certainly kind of one of the center, or, you know, most vocal, most prominent gay people, and kind of fell into his crowd. And so, you know, I was very quickly going to Fire Island and, you know, on kind of the, you know, gay professional circuit.
When did you become aware of the presence of HIV/AIDS in New York?
I became aware of it really early because of my friendship with Larry Kramer, and he started organizing something that was called at the time the Network, which was a group of, you know, gay and lesbian activists who, you know, were kind of leaders of the gay liberation kind of movement, and some physicians like Larry Massey and, you know, people like Michael Callan and Vito Russo and other people, you know, Nathan Quadner, you know, the people who helped start GMHC, began meeting with, you know, Larry Massey was a physician, and Joe Sonnabian and some others, on a regular basis to kind of share information about, you know, this new illness grid that was, you know, cropping up in the community. And I went to that group for a while, and that was, you know, that was in 81, I think, 81, 82. And I actually ended up buying a brownstone and started renovating it myself, and kind of fell out of that group before actually it became GMHC. Because I was, you know, literally spending time renovating brownstone.
When did you get infected yourself?
Well, I think I was actually infected in a visit to New York City before I moved here. I'm pretty sure I was infected on New Year's Eve, you know, the 31st of December in 1979. Because I went back to Colorado the first week of January in 1980 and became really ill with flu-like symptoms, and, you know, developed really bad swollen lymph nodes. They thought I had mono, then they thought I had Hodgkin's disease, and the blood work didn't show up as either, but I was really sick, really bad diarrhea, you know, really swollen lymph nodes, and it went on for, you know, a number of weeks until it finally, you know, subsided. And probably about a year later, I came down with shingles and, you know, some kind of weird fungal infections in my armpits and groin, and so I was, you know, likely infected based on what I can put together and my doctors can put together, you know. And, you know, that particular night I went to a place called Flamingo, which was, you know, a major, you know, it was kind of the center of the, you know, gay dance world at that time. It's, you know, it was kind of run out of business by a place called The Saint, but it was like the premier dance palace at the time, and I was, you know, doing White Crosses that night, which are a form of, you know, form of methamphetamine, and so I was really high, and, you know, went home with two other guys, and, you know, we basically had sex for like, you know, 16 hours.
And when were you actually diagnosed?
I was diagnosed actually, that, you know, they actually did some, you know, biopsies, you know, both on this weird skin condition and for, you know, Hodgkin's disease. And neither of those things happened, you know, ended up being, you know, wasn't KS. And, it, you know, I didn't have lymphoma. But those tests were like 82. And my boyfriend came down with Kaposi sarcoma in 1984. And sometime, you know, after he was diagnosed with KS, the our doctor got access to the early HIV antibody tests and tested me under my boyfriend's name because he already had an AIDS diagnosis with, because of the Kaposi sarcoma, and I was positive at that time. So I think that was, it was either 84 or 85.
And you mentioned before that you went on disability from your job. Were you sick at the time?
Well, I wasn't really sick at the time, but in December of 1981, wait, let me take that back. In December of 1991, my former employer, which was a management consulting firm, forced me onto long-term disability. And I had already been in, you know, clinical trials for AZT and DDI and...
91, you mean 10 years later?
Yeah, yeah. And I'd been in, you know, clinical trials for something called TP5, you know, my boyfriend had died, I had been on the Donahue show talking about, you know, how I'd been discriminated against by my employer and not given time off from work to take care of him when he was sick, and, you know, that he died on an airplane on the way to visit his mother with his secretary because my boss wouldn't give me the time off from work to take him to see his mother for the last time. And so there was a really contentious relationship between myself and my former employer who, you know, had tried to basically drive me out of the company, but I, you know, went on the Donahue show and did other things and fought back. And when I came down with an AIDS diagnosis, you know, my boss happened to, find out from a colleague that I had been diagnosed as having full-blown AIDS and realized that my company's long-term disability program would, you know, pay, you know, for, you know, would pay for me to have health insurance and, you know, a portion of my salary, you know, for the rest of my life. And they, you know, were in need of staff layoffs because of the fact that, you know, business, it was a kind of a bad period in the business cycle. And they, you know, came to me and said, you know, look, you know, you have AIDS, you can qualify for long-term disability, you're doing all this activism, you're not really that productive as an employee. Everybody else in our unit is either married, most of them have kids, a number of them are, you know, the only breadwinner in their family. You know, you can go on long-term disability and still get income and health insurance, so we want you to apply for long-term disability so we don't have to fire somebody or lay somebody off. And I said, well, you know, I'm not sure that I'm ready to do that. I'm healthy enough to work. And they basically said, you know, well, you know, here is your, you know, last 6 months worth of phone bills, and they threw something on the desk. Everything that is highlighted are calls you've made to AIDS organizations or government employees as an AIDS activist. None of these people are your clients. You know, here are your billing sheets. Your billable hours have depreciated 40%, and you know, since you became an activist, and you know, based on these two things alone, we have reason to fire you. So we can fire you, or you can apply for long-term disability, and we won't even lay you off, and so you won't get the severance package. So you choose.
And when had you become an activist?
Well, that was in the end of 91, and we started ACT UP in 1987, in March of 87. And so my partner died in July of 1986, and I had renovated a couple of brownstones at that point in Harlem, and so I had some housing development skills. And ironically, my partner's father had died of AIDS also. He died in 1983. Before Scott actually was diagnosed with AIDS. His father had had a triple bypass operation in Chicago in 1980, and you know, came down with AIDS from a blood transfusion that he got during the triple bypass operation, and died really quickly and on a horrendous death. He was in the hospital, and you know, this was before they knew how to treat, you know, PCP, pneumonia, and a bunch of other things. And the Chicago suburb hospital where he was, you know, in the hospital for several months was really AIDS phobic, and the nurses, and you know, wouldn't bathe him, wouldn't shave him, wouldn't wash his hair. My partner was literally flying home on weekends to, you know, shave his father and give him a bath and wash his hair. And you know, he'd come back talking about how, you know, literally the tubes you know, that were feeding him or, you know, giving him oxygen, you know, had like just phlegm crusted all over them, and nobody was even like, you know, cleaning the phlegm off of the tubes. And he was having to go in and, you know, insist that they change the tubes and, you know, do all this kind of stuff because, you know, nobody, you know, even his own mother-in-law, no, stepmother, was afraid to touch or bathe his father, her own, you know, husband, because of AIDS phobia. And so Scott was really insistent that he never be hospitalized. And even though he had several bouts of pneumonia, his physician, who was a personal friend, always came to the house to hang IV bags and what have you. And so when I learned there were a lot of homeless people with AIDS, and you know, having known how Scott insisted on being, you know, cared for at home so that he didn't get suboptimal care, I decided that I would use my, you know, housing renovation skills to try to develop some AIDS housing. So I called Larry Kramer up and said, "Hey, Larry, Scott died. I've been doing renovations for buildings in Harlem. I would like to try to get in touch with other people who are trying to provide housing for homeless people with AIDS, because there's lots of buildings in my neighborhood and I know how to renovate buildings, so I'd like to try to develop some AIDS housing." And he said, "Oh, that's a great idea. You should talk to Doug Dornan, you should talk to Bailey House, you know, blah, 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 the AIDS Resources Center, but I'm giving a speech at the community center in 2 weeks where I'm actually going to call for a civil disobedience organization to be founded to, you know, do some, you know, anti-war type protest to try to get the government to, you know, do more research to find, you know, a cure for AIDS and you know, to try to get a more appropriate, you know, societal response. You know, would you come to the speech and, you know, be a plan in the audience, and when I call for volunteers, stand up and be one of the people that, you know, offers to help and, you know, give any suggestions you can on, you know, how we can organize the first demos?" And I said, "Sure." So, you know, I agreed to do that and was at the first speech and was one of the first people who stood up, and I was young and better looking at the time and had a very pretty boyfriend, and the two of us became some of the early poster childs of AIDS activists, because we were both out about our HIV status and being gay and very involved. And so
can you explain to me the foundational motives or ideology of ACT UP early on?
Yeah, well, I mean, ACT UP took a lot of its development cues from the early gay and lesbian liberation movement and from the kind of anti-war movement. We decided really early on that we were going to use Robert's Rule of Order, that we were going to be an equalitarian organization where every voice had equal weight, that we were going to, do a majority rule voting process to determine what we would do, that members of our group would facilitate discussions, that, people could present their ideas, that we wanted to do, kind of in-your-face street theater types of demonstrations that were nonviolent in nature, but that, drew public attention to our issues. There were lots of people that were writers and actors and, in entertainment in one way or the other the organization. And so, we kind of quickly, learned that theatrics, street theater, and kind of sexy images, graphics, gimmicks were really effective at drawing media attention. And we, quickly learned that the media was really lazy and stupid and, never properly represented the images or the issues that we were trying to draw attention to in their articles, and that if we had, posters and graphics that clearly spelled out the intent of the demonstration, our demands, that as long as there was a photo op of the posters that we had produced for the event, the message would get conveyed to the public. And so we started using, kind of sexy, graphics and posters like, some of these that are reflected in this book, so that, we made it very clear what we were, trying, the message we were trying to get to the public. That, if we use controversial, things like erect penises or, clean needles, this is talking about, the number of people in prison that are HIV positive and the use of needles and, sexual violence in prisons and how it was infecting lots of people in prison and nothing was being done about it. We were doing things like kiss-ins in the middle of the street to draw attention to how homophobia was undermining the epidemic and the response. Saying things like, all people with HIV are innocent in response to the innocent victims' priorities of early AIDS programs, where they only wanted to help the poor children whose mothers, transmitted the virus to them, and not the homos or the junkies who, deserve to get HIV. And, we were, drawing attention to governmental leaders who were shirking their responsibilities. Ronald Reagan never said the word AIDS or talked about HIV for the first 7 years of his presidency. And so, we basically, called him a murderer. You know, one out of 61 babies were born HIV positive in New York in the early days of HIV. You know, those types of messages we were, you know, trying to make very, very clear to the public. And the use of these graphics and doing things like, you know, here we had constructed a concentration camp on the back of a float bed truck for Gay Pride Parade. It was the first ACT UP presence in New York City's Gay Pride demonstration in 1987. We literally, you know, me with my power tools and some friends, you know, constructed a tower, you know, on the flatbed of a pickup truck and used 2x4s for, you know, fence posts and use, you know, barbed wire and mesh to, you know, make a concentration camp on the back of a pickup truck with a, you know, rifle tower up by the cab. And I literally sat on the roof of the U-Haul rental truck in a Ronald Reagan suit with a Ronald Reagan mask on, you know, and rubber gloves, yellow, you know, rubber gloves, like laughing and pointing at the AIDS victims that were in the back while, you know, people in police and military uniforms with, you know, masks on and rubber gloves walked around the, you know, perimeter of the concentration camp. And the banner on the side of the float said, "Test drugs, not people."
Were you severely policed by the authorities?
Our early demonstrations were, and, you know, there were, you know, that image of the police in big rubber gloves actually came from this demonstration that's photoed here. It was the first demonstration we had at the White House, and a number of leaders of AIDS organizations and gay and lesbian organizations and some political officials, you know, pre-scripted a die-in in front of the White House where they would be arrested to draw, you know, more media attention to the fact that people were going to jail over the lack of a governmental AIDS response. And the police showed up with rubber gloves, but not, you know, medical rubber gloves, but, you know, orange, you know, kinds of rubber gloves that you would use to clean your toilet, and, you know, medical masks or painting, you know, respirators, you know, because they were touching the people who may have HIV and they didn't want to get, you know, AIDS from them. And actually, my boyfriend at the time, and it even says here, you know, your gloves won't match your shoes. They'll see it in the news. My flamboyant boyfriend started, you know, laughing like hell when he saw these yellow rubber gloves on these cops with big, you know, riot gear on, with, you know, knee-high police boots that were black. And he started yelling, "Your gloves won't match your shoes. They'll see it in the news. Your gloves don't match your shoes." And it immediately became the chant for any time that, you know, we did a demonstration where the police showed up in riot gear. So this is one of my favorite images from the AIDS epidemic. And it was when ACT UP invaded the St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, near Saks Fifth Avenue. The Archbishop John O'Connor is, you know, wearing a hat that looks an awful lot like an unrolled condom. And the ad says, you know your scumbag. And under the condom it says, "This one prevents HIV." Cardinal O'Connor was blocking the distribution of safe sex information and condoms in New York City public high schools. We invaded his church because he needed to get out of the education system and stop killing people by denying them access to safe sex education and condoms.
How was the government responding to this growing civil movement at the time? Did you get any were you addressed directly?
Well, you know, what ended up happening was, you know, we had kind of a two-pronged approach to any kind of an action. You know, we learned really early on that it wasn't enough just to bring a list of demands, that we really needed to frame totally the entire issue we were addressing. We needed to provide background information about, you know, what was the situation. We needed to have a list of demands of things we wanted corrected. And then we needed to have some type of an action plan where corrective action could be taken to resolve the problem. So, for example, on homelessness and AIDS, you know, the background information would be there are X number of homeless people in New York City, you know, say 100,000 of those, you know, 56% or, you know, 56,000 are testing HIV positive based on percentage of tests in shelter medical programs. People with HIV are more susceptible for tuberculosis because of the fact that HIV kills CD4 macrophages, which are the same blood cells that killed the tuberculosis germs. You know, people who have HIV are really susceptible for TB. More than 60% of people in New York City shelters test positive for tuberculosis. Therefore, co-locating people with AIDS with people who are positive for TB is causing a tuberculosis outbreak in the shelters that is overflooding the hospitals in New York, where there was a huge TB outbreak. And therefore, to, you know, we need medically appropriate housing to, you know, alleviate the tuberculosis problems in New York City housing and the tuberculosis problem in the New York City shelters. And this housing needs to be medically appropriate, have proper ventilation, have proper nutrition, allow people who are sick and weak to stay in the shelters, you know, or in the housing programs during the day and not be thrown out on the street at 7 a.m. and not able to return to the shelters until 8 p.m., which was the current, programmatic guidelines for homeless people. They were thrown out on the street at 7 a.m. They couldn't come back to the shelter until 8 p.m. And they were given no meals. So, you know, for somebody who was sick with HIV, you know, you were basically guaranteeing that, and they were homeless, you were guaranteeing they'd die really quickly.
How large had ACT UP grown to be at this point? How many members were participating?
Well, ACT UP grew really quickly, really, you know, grew very large, really, really quickly. The first demonstration was organized, you know, the speech Larry Kramer had, you know, given calling for the formation of ACT UP had less than a couple hundred people at it. You know, somewhere between 24 and 30 people showed up for 3 weeks, you know, in meetings at his apartment to organize the first demonstration. We had probably, you know, under 200 people show up at the first demonstration on Wall Street, where there were, you know, kind of a dozen pre-scripted arrests. But the media were all over it because, you know, we publicized it. We had Joseph Papp, who was the, you know, creative director of the New York Shakespeare in the Park program, and the the Joseph Papp Public Theater, you know, built a life-size puppet of Frank Young, who was the head of the FDA, and we hung him from a light post. And, you know, we blocked, you know, Wall Street with a no more business as usual, you know, drug companies need to invest, you know, money to find a cure for AIDS. And, you know, did lots of media work ahead of time. And so the news for days were all about this, you know, new gay group that was demonstrating, you know, about a better response for HIV. And, you know, the next week, you know, our meetings went from the, you know, 30 or 40 people in Larry's apartment to several hundred, you know, about 300 people in the Gay and Lesbian Community Center. And after the next couple of demonstrations, we literally had 800 people showing up at our meetings, and we had to move from the Gay and Lesbian Community Center to Cooper Union to their large meeting hall, because, you know, we'd have up to 1,000 people showing up for demonstrations. ACT UP went from being just a New York chapter to, you know, over 100 chapters in the U.S. and, you know, over 24 chapters around the world in less than 2 years. So,
can you describe how these meetings functioned? Because with 800 people, was it a collective meeting of everybody at once, or were there subgroups and working in different issues?
Well, you know, we learned really quickly that, you know, we needed some kind of an operating procedure, and so we organized a coordinating committee first we kind of like developed a working document that kind of spelled out how the meetings would be run. And that was kind of developed by, you know, a couple of members. I was one of the person that was involved in a team. The primary drafter of the working document was a guy named Stephen Webb, who was a writer but also an ex-hustler. The roommate of a guy named Barry Gingell, who was a medical doctor with AIDS, who was smuggling drugs from Mexico and Canada into the U.S., which were being tested by the governments of Mexico and Canada as treatments for HIV, which were not being tested in this country. And so he was smuggling them into the country to treat patients with. And, you know, Geraldo was profiling on, you know, the Geraldo show, him smuggling the drugs in and blah, blah, blah. So this medical director, Barry Gingell, and his roommate, Stephen Webb, drafted this working document that was based on Robert's Rules of Order and talked about a process by which, you know, two facilitators, a man and a woman, would, you know, coordinate the meetings and what the, you know, how the agendas would be formulated, and that they would be presented and voted on by the public, and, you know, that there should be emergency announcements up front, you know, that everybody wanted to know, and then there would be, you know, a discussion of actions that, you know, needed to happen to create a, you know, resolve a problem, and then there would be a report section that would report back on work that was being done by groups of people that then became formal committees. And, you know, eventually, you know, there were so many committees meeting on issues, scientific information, housing, women's issues, pediatric AIDS, that, you know, we decided, well, you know, there needs to be a way to coordinate the work of these committees, so let's have a coordinating committee of elected representatives from each of the committees that would meet on Monday nights or Sunday nights before the ACT UP meeting on Monday to decide what the agenda would be and what the actions, you know, could be presented for that week. And so, you know, this very grassroots, you know, model of running the organization became crafted into this working document that we then started, you know, sending to cities and activists all over the U.S. and eventually all over the world to let them know how we were running our organization and how we were organizing our demonstrations. And we, you know, developed, you know, an activist guide to, you know, a demonstration, model press releases, model fact sheets that, you know, had the, you know, overview, you know, goals and objectives, the background information, the demand section, the, you know, action items. You know, we, you know, literally started coming up with all these tools to help other organizations form their own ACT UP chapters and, you know, join our work, but decided that we would not be a national organization. We didn't want that kind of administrative structure. We would share information and tools and ideas, and we would have coordinating calls, conference calls between all of the varying chapters to kind of coordinate national actions. But each chapter was its own freestanding thing, would have to raise its own money, would do its, you know, its own organizing, set its own priorities, develop its own committee structures. And so, you know, we formed this loose-leafed collective of chapters, you know, that were local chapters based on a city as opposed to a state kind of model, that would, you know, collaborate when possible, but would function basically independently and autonomously.
At the same time that you're doing this work with ACT UP, you start to do the work with the housing committee? and found housing works?
The housing committee was one of the, you know, early committees that we established within ACT UP to focus on issues about housing. And initially, I was trying to help this real estate developer and then work with, you know, the Jewish Board for Children and Family Services and the Episcopal Archdiocese of New York and, you know, a couple of other groups to develop some housing. But it became clear really early on that the faith-based priorities of those organizations were interfering with, condom distribution, and they had all kinds of moral overtones, and they were trying to, you know, tell people with HIV not to have sex. You can't bring people into, you know, the housing program to have sex here. We won't distribute condoms. We won't give women information about family planning. We don't want women to have an abortion if they're pregnant with HIV, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so we realized that we couldn't get housing programs to run effective and, you know, humanistic viable housing programs for people with HIV that we would want to live in ourselves, and that we couldn't get AIDS organizations to take on the added burden of trying to create housing. And if anyone was going to develop medically appropriate humane housing, it would be us. And so we decided to incorporate a 501(c), raise our own money, and, you know, start developing our own AIDS housing. And at the same time, you know, we organized the housing committee primarily to do advocacy to combat inappropriate governmental or private housing initiatives. The initial approach was develop AIDS-specific housing. The New York State Social Service Department actually came forward with a plan to develop a joint TB HIV housing wing of the Bellevue shelter, and because people with TB and people with HIV were both really tired and needed to sleep a lot, and both had, you know, wasting syndrome and lost a lot of weight and therefore needed additional nutrition, we'd give them, you know, their own floors and their own wings in, you know, the Bellevue Men's Shelter. We'd give them extra bologna sandwiches and we'd let them stay there all day if they were too weak to leave. And that was their, you know, their brilliant approach to housing homeless people with HIV, you know, when it was clearly medically inappropriate to co-locate people with TB and HIV. And so we literally had to blow the roof off of the fact that New York State was trying to create TB incubation units to kill people with HIV, and that was a really good spin for the news. And, you know, within a short period and a few demonstrations where we collected furniture in pickup trucks and, you know, set up, you know, living rooms and bedrooms in the street in front of the Housing Preservation and Development Office of the City of New York. We, you know, literally got both the City of New York and the State of New York to meet our demand to have each contribute $25 million of capital funds to create medically appropriate AIDS housing. And, you know, we got those two funds set up, you know, literally within a matter of a couple months.
How did Housing Works work?
Housing Works actually, you know, the Housing Committee was formed to do all these actions to draw attention, to beat back these ineffective programs, and then to advocate for medically appropriate housing. But when we realized that nobody was really going to do medically appropriate housing other than us, we incorporated a nonprofit. We, you know, got a wealthy donor to, you know, give us seed money, give us part of his wife's office, let her secretary be our secretary. You know, we hired our first employee, Charles King, who is still the president of Housing Works, to start raising grant money. And, you know, we started filing grant applications, and we got development money for a Model AIDS housing program that I put together from the New York State AIDS Institute that, you know, hired staff to develop, you know, the first AIDS housing model. And then we applied for scattered site housing programs, grants from the city of New York for a program we helped develop, which was where an agency could hire social service staff to do the case management work and the drug treatment and referral to medical providers for homeless people with HIV, and place those homeless people in apartments that were rented just out of, you know, public housing stock, you know, out of a small building owner in the Bronx who has, you know, five vacancies in his 40-unit building. You know, we got the city to agree to, you know, let us hire caseworkers to give us the rent money to pay for those five apartments and for us to coordinate the medical and social needs of those people that we were putting, you know, taking out of the shelter system and putting into those apartments.
As medical treatment became more accessible and science started to develop, how did these two organizations start to change? And what that initial kind of urgency that arose as a kind of social movement, it seemed like it changed at some point. Can you give your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, part, I guess, of the demise of ACT UP, and it went from being, you know, several thousand people, you know, in New York and, you know, 800 or 1,000 people coming to a meeting, and kind of contracted back to 200 or 300 people around the mid-90s when the HIV cocktail, you know, was approved. And, you know, that was, that primarily happened for two reasons. One, when effective treatments became available, all of our friends stopped dying. And so it was no longer, you know, literally a war siege where the community had to engage in the response, you know, as a coordinated community, as if we were fighting a war, because all of our community members were dying around us like flies and nobody was doing anything to respond. The fact that people were getting on treatments and kind of their health was being restored and the number of deaths was dramatically reducing, you know, ended the crisis siege, and a lot of people who weren't infected or just had friends that were, you know, and had careers and whatever, they kind of went back to their normal lives. And then when, you know, we succeeded in getting all kinds of funding streams, like the Ryan White Care Act, the Housing Opportunities for People with AIDS housing programs set up, the AIDS Drug Assistance Program to provide, you know, people who were not, you know, so poor that they would qualify for Medicaid and Medicare and welfare, but, you know, didn't have health insurance. ADAP provides them with access to, you know, HIV medications and doctors. You know, those types of programs, and private giving, you know, foundation support, etc., created a lot of AIDS service organizations that started hiring activists to do, you know, the work for them. And lots of activists started creating organizations that either raised its own money or, you know, applied for government grants or foundation grants or, you know, ran private fundraisers, you know, to pay for organizations to do, you know, certain things that were needed by people with HIV. And so a lot of activists got drained away from doing activism into full-time, you know, paid staff positions in these organizations. So that dramatically kind of dissipated the activist movement. You know, the kind of seat of activism began to shift away from the United States or the developed world country focus to a developing world focus, because we were, you know, getting access to treatments and programs and safety nets in the U.S., in Canada, in France, in Germany, and, you know, countries with you know, governments that were democratic and that, you know, had adequate economies to provide, you know, need to people with HIV. But the developing world had access to nothing, and so the seed of activism or the focus of activism, you know, changed, and I was one of the, you know, the first people that started organizing international things, you know, because I was getting invited to lots of international conferences and lots of global meetings of the UN and the World Health Organization and other, you know, associations of nurses and, you know, medical doctors and blah, 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 to speak about AIDS activism, about living with HIV, about housing issues, and started meeting lots of people living with HIV from developing countries who couldn't get aspirin, who couldn't get treatments for, you know, thrush or anti-diarrheal medications or you know, things to treat pneumonia. And so...
Is that when you joined UNAIDS?
No, that's actually when I helped first start something called the Global AIDS Action Committee of ACT UP New York. I eventually went on the board of the Global Network of People Living with HIV, which was kind of like a global person with AIDS coalition, and, you know, helped organize the first conference for people with HIV in South Africa in Cape Town in 94 or 5, and then started, you know, working on lots of task forces for UNAIDS, etc. And then eventually I was invited, not until 2008 actually, to come kind of inside UNAIDS after having organized all the activist work outside, putting pressure on UNAIDS. I got invited to come in and help facilitate the HIV community's input into the UN processes on HIV.
Is HIV a crisis in the developing world at the moment?
Oh, there's still a huge crisis in the developing world. We're making, you know, a certain level of progress on that crisis, but for example, in 2006, there was a declaration of commitment signed at the UN by, you know, just under 200 countries, where they made commitments to reduce the number of people, of new infections every year, to try to reduce the number of deaths by HIV. They literally made a commitment to get everyone who needed access to HIV medications, access to HIV medications by the year 2010, by December of 2010. We're in 2011 now, and while the World Health Organization and the UNAIDS own statistics say that around 15 million people need to be on HIV medications today, we have just over 5 million people on HIV treatments around the world. So only a third of people who need treatment today are on HIV medications. So we've, you know, failed in obtaining, as a global society, the universal access commitment. And there will be a meeting in 2011 in June, which is one of the things that I'm working on right now, where governments will negotiate a new commitment to delineate the global HIV response by governments for the next 5 or 10 years.
Is AIDS activism today primarily professionalized, or are there in any of these developing countries movements that could be compared to the impact and the effect that ACT UP had here and in other countries?
Well, there still is a lot of activism happening at a grassroots level by non-professionals. Many networks of people living with HIV are still doing not only the majority of activism and advocacy around HIV, but they're also still providing a major portion of the care, support, and services for people living with HIV. There are some, you know, global networks and some national networks and some, you know, local organizations of professionals who do, you know, more advocacy as opposed to activism, although some of them do activism in kind of the, you know, activist definition. But one of the last things to be resourced, to be provided funding and human you know, resources, bodies, you know, paid salaries, is activism, is advocacy. You know, people will, you know, give money to, you know, caseworkers, to doctors, to nurses. They'll give money to take care of orphans, but they don't view activism or advocacy as, you know, something that, you know, should be paid. That's, you know, confronting government, that's holding government accountable. So why would government pay for people to criticize them? And so activism, you know, is suffering, you know, dramatically around the world. And you know, these grassroots groups of people living with HIV that are doing a lot of the educational work, a lot of the care and support for people living with HIV, for their extended families, a lot of the groups that are actually delivering treatments to people with HIV are, if not totally unfunded, dramatically underfunded, so that these organizations that are doing a lion's share of the work are not getting the adequate level of financing and support that they need to do their jobs well.
How do you think the younger generation of queer Americans in this country, or people in this country, have learned from the legacy of ACT UP? How is AIDS perceived today in the midst of it being a controllable disease via medication? And what is the, is there an, a sense of urgency in that today?
Well, it's really problematic that there's been a huge kind of generational divide between, you know, queer youth and my generation, or the generation, you know, that immediately followed me. Most young people today, including queer people and you know, queer activists, you know, grew up after HIV virus was discovered, and after the HIV epidemic, you know, was widely known, and you know, many of them, you know, became young adults, teenagers and young adults, after the AIDS cocktail, you know, came, you know, to market. So, you know, we're in 2011. You know, anybody who was born in, say, 1996, you know, when HIV medication, you know, was approved and became widely available in the U.S., you know, those people are, you know, about to enter their 20s, and people that were, you know, in grade school or high school at that time, you know, are young adults. And so most of them, you know, think of HIV as a chronic illness that you can take the AIDS cocktail and, you know, live healthy lives and continue to work. And they don't see, you know, AIDS as a crisis. They don't have a sense of urgency. They don't fear HIV. And so they're, you know, not that concerned about getting HIV. They're engaging in unsafe behavior. They're wisely and unacceptably exposing themselves to risk of HIV infection, and a lot of them are getting HIV. And you know, the media perception, part of which is fueled by, you know, drug company ads and commercials that, you know, see somebody, you know, climbing a mountain or running a marathon, you know, while he's, you know, taking his, you know, latest approved, you know, Truvada or, you know, whatever HIV medication, you know, thinking that that one pill is going to allow them to, you know, run marathons and climb mountains, not knowing that there are horrendous side effects, that the drugs don't work for everybody, that, you know, people, you know, are developing neuropathy and diabetes and liver and kidney problems and, you know, wasting syndromes and heart, you know, cardiovascular disease and peripheral vascular disease and, you know, a whole you know, laundry list of side effects that are debilitating and often kill people far, far earlier than someone would die if they weren't HIV infected and getting these complications that are caused by these side effects. And
are these some of the issues that ACT UP is working on today?
It's definitely, you know, some of the issues that ACT UP is working on, and, you know, we're trying to, you know, re-engage young people around the need for condom use and safer sex practices and safer needle use and harm reduction techniques and, you know, encouraging people not to get infected with HIV. And, you know, it's difficult. There's also huge ageism amongst the queer community. And, you know, when you're young and pretty and have a great body and, you know, can go out and party all night and whatever, you're cool and hip and, you know, everybody wants to know you. But, you know, if you are a bit older, if you, you know, have gray hair, don't have a gym body, you know, don't party all night, you know, whatever, you know, who the fuck wants to talk to you? And so, you know, there isn't much mentoring happening, and there isn't much cross generational dialogue between gay youth and, you know, older gays and lesbians.
What are your thoughts on pornography and the subculture of barebacking as it is promoted by pornography? And how do you think that it comes to become such a growing force in a sense?
Well, I think it, you know, it's become, you know, desirable because, you know, it's new and it's dangerous and it's, you know, exciting because it's dangerous and it's something you're not supposed to be doing, and therefore it's all the more exciting. And you know, there was a time period when, you know, pornographers felt a sense of responsibility to ensure that all of their you know, actors, you know, engaged in safe sex, and they made a big deal out of showing people putting on condoms, and there was an effort to try to eroticize condom use. Well, then a few people started saying, you know, well, fuck that, you know, it's really hot to, you know, take a load of cum up your ass, and started, you know, doing barebacking videos, and then it was like, oh my God, did you see that? Oh my God, that's so hot, you know, and so then it became, you know, edgy and in vogue and whatever to say, oh, fuck it, you know, don't tell us how to fuck, you know. And, you know, barebacking porno became, you know, cool. And it's really awful because, you know, it's encouraging a lot of people to take a lot of risks that, you know, they're eventually going to really regret.